Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Colleen Wilcox, member of the Board of Governors. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce, of course, a man who needs no introduction, Ted Koppel, author of Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath. Ted is a 42-year veteran of ABC News and spent 25 years as the anchor and managing editor of Nightline. He retired from Nightline in 2005 and later served as the managing editor for the Discovery Channel, senior news analyst for NPR, and contributing analyst to BBC, World News America, and NBC News. Ted has won every single major broadcasting award there is, including 42 Emmy Awards, 8 Peabody Awards, 11 Overseas Press Club Awards. He was also named Broadcaster of the Year by International Television and Radio Society and was an inductee into the Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Moderating this evening's conversation is our own Steve Sum, who is the editor of Santa Clara Magazine. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ted Koppel and Steve Sum.
Good evening, everyone, and good evening, Ted Koppel. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. It just occurred to me when my oldest daughter first saw the title of the book, Lights Out, Ted Koppel, she said, "Dad, is this autobiographical?"
I thought you might say she thought you were writing a children's book.
Well,
right?
That too. It is neither.
It's kind of a scary book, and one that I think perhaps has some special resonance here in Silicon Valley. And I'm wondering if we can start off with talking about that. And again, I'll invite audience members to make sure you pass your questions so we can make that part of the conversation.
Sure.
But why, what is it about this book that you think might have special resonance here in digitally connected Silicon Valley?
You know something? This is probably not the way to endear myself to Google and the others, but I don't care if it has special resonance here. The point of writing this book is to alert the American public at large that we only have 3 power grids in this country. That this is not me saying that there is a danger of a cyber attack against one or more of the power grids. It is not me saying that not just the possibility, but the likelihood exists that if all or part of one of those grids is taken down, tens of millions of Americans will be without power for as long as months at a time. What first induced me to look into the subject of the book was the fact that the president twice raised this issue in a State of the Union, in 2 State of the Union addresses, that former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, who has his own institute just up the road here, when he was Secretary of Defense, warned of a cyber Pearl Harbor. And it just occurred to me that somebody ought to be looking into the question of what, if anything, the federal government is doing to prepare in particular for this kind of an attack. And my hunch was not much, and not much turned out to be an exaggeration. In point of fact, the FEMA and Department of Homeland Security are well prepared for natural disasters, for hurricanes, for even earthquakes, for floods, for any number of natural disasters. But this is different. It, first of all, is going to affect far more people, and secondly, and I'm just going to ramble for a couple of minutes here, Stephen, and then we can get into your more particular questions, but the reason I don't care about Silicon Valley in particular is the great danger here is to our larger urban centers. The great danger here is if a city like New York, for example, is hit, and it wouldn't just be New York City. It would be New York and surrounding states, maybe as many as 8 or 10 states. So what you're talking about is a huge number of people facing a major catastrophe. And particularly in the large urban centers, people don't have emergency generators. People don't keep a storehouse of a week's worth or a month's worth of food. If my kids are any example, and they have kids of their own, they order out as much as they cook in. And the likelihood of the 8 million people who make up the 5 boroughs of New York being able to survive for very long is slim. I talked, among other experts, to the man who was the head of Homeland Security for the state of New York, and I said, how many meals ready to eat do you have? Those meals ready to eat are what the military have, and they are actually, they're very good, and they're very nourishing, and they have many calories, and you could live for a long time on one MRE a day. And he said, I think we have about 23 or 24 million of them. And I said, well, if only the city of New York is hit, that'll last you about 3 days, right? He said, right. I said, then what are you going to do? He said, then we're going to be in real trouble. So, that's just for openers.
Well, so you mentioned Obama, you mentioned Panetta. Who else has expressed some concern or tried to put this on the radar for people?
Well, I talked to the commander of CENTCOM, General Lloyd Austin. He said it's not a question of if this happens, it's a question of when it happens. I talked to Janet Napolitano, who is now the president just up the road of the University of California. She was for 5 years Secretary of Homeland Security. And one of the reasons I started looking into this is she was one of the people who issued a warning. Her farewell speech was at the National Press Club in Washington. And when I called her about a year ago and spoke to her, I said, what do you think the chances are of a successful cyber attack on the power grid? And she said, high, very high, 80% to 90%. When people like Janet Napolitano, General Austin, Leon Panetta, the president, Keith Alexander, the retired 4-star general who headed up the NSA, the man who is the current head of the NSA, Admiral Mike Rogers, only about 2 weeks ago, attending a conference that the Wall Street Journal gave, said, the likelihood of a successful cyber attack on our infrastructure is almost inevitable. These are serious people. They don't say things like this without considering what the impact is going to be. But what has struck me is that the impact has been negligible. I thought people would be astonished by those kinds of statements. And I thought that when I began looking into the issue of what the federal government has done to prepare, that there would be some kind of a plan. I find that there is none. No plan.
So is the problem that a combination of, one, it's seeming unreal because we haven't seen something like this happen yet, and maybe we can come back to that. And two, where do you begin on the scale of preparation that we're talking about?
Well, let's start off with one. When you say we haven't seen anything like it happen yet, you're exactly right. We haven't. What we have seen is Target being hit to the tune of, I think, more than 100 million of their customers having credit card information stolen. What we have seen is banks like J.P. Morgan. And Jamie Dimon told me at one point that J.P. Morgan, and this was 2 years ago that I spoke to him, he said at that point that they had invested more than $650 million in cybersecurity. They're close to having invested $1 billion in cybersecurity. And yet more than 100 million of their clients' files were hacked. Only last year at this time, the personnel records of 22.1 million current and former federal employees, including employees of the CIA, the FBI, the Defense Department, the State Department, were in effect vacuumed up by Chinese intelligence using a cyber attack. There is not a company, major company in this country, that has not been hacked many times over. And yet somehow we remain secure in our expectation that an attack on one of our power grids or on the infrastructure is not going to happen. I assure you, at one point or another, it is going to happen. And we need to start making preparations.
Well, one of the examples or precedents that you talk about in the book is the Stuxnet virus.
Yes.
Which was created by the United States, presumably.
By the United States and Israel. Stuxnet, as many of you probably know, was a virus that was introduced into the Iranian nuclear program at their nuclear plant in Natanz. And the genius of it was it caused the, the spinning?
The centrifuges.
Centrifuges, thank you. I was having a senior moment there. Caused the centrifuges to spin out of control. And the genius of what we and the Israelis did, it was something, out of the movie Ocean's 11. They arranged to insert video into the control room showing these centrifuges spinning at precisely the correct speed, so that when the people in the operations area in Natanz were looking up at their video board there, they were seeing everything operating perfectly while the centrifuges, in reality, were spinning out of control. So, the irony of all ironies, the paradox is going to be, just as we have spent the last 50-some-odd years trying to put the nuclear genie that we unleashed over Hiroshima and Nagasaki back into the bottle again, so too, we are now trying to control the cyber genie. The only difference being that whereas nuclear weapons are in relatively few hands, the cyber weapon is in thousands upon thousands of hands.
Well, and one of the comparisons that you make is the difference between all the years when nuclear weapons were in so few hands, and the real danger seemed to be the exchange of weapons between the United States and the Soviet Union with a verifiable source.
Right.
A cyber attack's a different thing.
That's a very good point, Stephen. It's, as dreadful as the concept was, had there been a nuclear attack against the United States, the president would almost immediately, within a couple of minutes of missiles leaving their silos in the Soviet Union, the president would have been alerted to the fact that X number of nuclear missiles are now headed toward the continental United States. And he would have had anywhere from 20 to 25 minutes to come up with a response to decide whether or not he wanted to launch a counterattack right away. The key point being, however, there would have been no doubt in the president's mind or in the minds of his advisors as to the origin of that attack. On the other hand, Simply think back to the attack that was launched against Sony Pictures not too long ago. And even though it was quite clear that the attack had something to do with the release of the movie that clearly was intended to mock and make fun of the North Vietnamese leader, it nevertheless took the FBI months before they could state with certainty that that particular cyber attack came from North Korea. So the great difference with the cyber attack is our officials will not know right away from where the attack was launched. And even if they do know from where the attack was launched, they don't necessarily know who launched it. It could have been some, I mean, first of all, the initial impression may be, the attack came from Ukraine. And then they begin to look a little bit further and they realize that it was routed to the Ukraine, but actually the routing came from Santiago, Chile. And then when they look at Santiago, Chile, they realize, no, that wasn't the point of origin. The actual point of origin was in Paris. And when they look closely at that, they say, no, it wasn't the original point of origin. It actually appears that the original point of origin was Cincinnati. Now what do you do? Whom do you blame? Whom do you target? What kind of response do you use? Because it may be, even if, let's say, the Russians were incautious enough to launch a cyber attack from Moscow, you don't necessarily know right away that the Russian government had anything to do with it. And does the president immediately respond by taking action against what would arguably be an undeniable act of war? If you knock out the electricity in one of our power grids in this country, thousands of people will die. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands. It will be a catastrophe the likes of which has never been wreaked on the American mainland. And if you can't tell who did it, how do you respond? That's a major problem.
Well, what that brings to mind is how you mentioned Panetta warning about a cyber Pearl Harbor, but Pearl Harbor wasn't an attack on the mainland on this scale. Although you in your childhood did live through a bombardment.
I did. I was born and grew up in England, and one of the points I make in the book is often the act of preparing for disaster takes us off in a totally incorrect direction. That was the case in Great Britain. Great Britain prepared for poison gas attacks prior to World War II. It was reasonable, after all, to expect that Adolf Hitler, a man who was using poison gas against quite literally millions of his own citizens and citizens in Poland and in Hungary, that he would do the same thing if and when he attacked Great Britain. For reasons that are not altogether clear, Hitler never used poison gas, but the British were ready for a poison gas attack. Thousands of nurses had been trained. Well over a million people were evacuated from the main urban centers in London. Fact of the matter is they found evacuation to be such an uncomfortable thing that more than half of them came back to London before the Blitz, and stayed in London during the Blitz, and gradually made accommodations. I remember in our backyard, we had a little bomb shelter. My good mother took one look at that bomb shelter. We spent one night in that bomb shelter, and she said, I'd rather take the consequences of whatever happens in the house. I'm never going back in that bomb shelter again. It turned out that those particular bomb shelters, they were essentially a piece of curved steel covered by 3 or 4 feet of dirt. They would have been totally useless in the event of a direct hit. My point, though, is preparations were made. There was a level of discipline and a sense of awareness among the British public that served it incredibly well. My father was a member of what was called the Home Guard. He and a neighbor would go off every night parading through the neighborhood, one of them carrying a broom and the other carrying a garbage can lid. The reason was that the Germans at that particular time were dropping incendiary devices on civilian neighborhoods. And if one of these incendiary bombs landed on a rooftop and was allowed to remain there, it burned through the roof and the whole house would go on fire. On the other hand, if someone climbed up on the roof with a broom and swept it down to the ground, and somebody else then put a garbage can lid over it and smothered it, that was it. Very simple, almost ludicrously simple, and yet there was a sense of awareness, a sense of preparedness, and part of my argument is sometimes we end up preparing for the wrong things, but the very act of preparing puts us in a mindset that says, things are coming that we need to be ready for. You're going to need food. You're going to need water. You're going to need to have sufficient medicine. And you've got to have a way, forgive me, this is not the kind of thing we normally think about, but when the power goes out, depending on where you live, if you live in a city, the water stops. Water is propelled by pumps. When the water stops, it's not just drinking water and cleaning water. Your toilet won't flush. When you have a community like New York City and you have 8 million people producing human waste every day, in very short order, that becomes a major health crisis. FEMA and groups like that will bring in emergency generators and try to at least keep the waste process going. Otherwise, they're going to have a huge health problem on their hands. But is there enough food? Does the government have enough food stored to take care of tens of millions of people? It does not. I spend 3 chapters of the book talking about the Mormons. There may be Mormons in the audience here. As you know, the Mormon Church recommends to its membership that every family have a 3 to 6 month supply of food. Some families, obviously, don't have the wherewithal to feed themselves on a daily basis. But if at least those of us who can afford it have enough food to take care of our own families for 3 months, and if the federal government were then to have an adequate food supply stored, it would take us over a period of 2 or 3 months, during which perhaps some solutions might be found. I'm not proposing this as the solution. I'm just saying right now the federal government is not offering any solution. We have to begin talking about it. This is not a partisan issue. It's not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. It has nothing to do with whether you're a conservative or a liberal. It is an issue that ultimately deals with survival. That's something I think we all have in common.
So one of the members of the audience here wants to know, is there any outreach to the tech industry to assist the government in fighting cyber attacks by trying to stay ahead of the attackers, or are we just doomed?
We're already behind the attackers. The Chinese and the Russians are already inside the grid. I don't want to mislead you. This is a tremendously complex issue. Tremendously complex in the sense that it takes years for an attacker to adequately map something as complex as the grid. But the Chinese have done it, and the Russians have done it. That's the bad news. The good news is that we have so many interlocking relationships with both the Chinese and the Russians that they're unlikely to pull the trigger. What is more alarming is that as you go down the level of competence, Chinese and the Russians clearly at the top, the Iranians come close behind. We have a lot of interlocking interests with Iran also, but not nearly as many. As you go down the list, you come to the North Koreans and the Syrians, with whom we have even fewer interlocking interests. And then you get down to the hacktivist groups and individual terrorist groups like ISIS, which has about $2 billion. And as the former chief scientist of the NSA told me, if you've got that much money, there is a lot of expertise out there that can be purchased, and what you need technologically can be bought off the shelf.
Well, that one of the fears at the end of
I didn't really address the question, and let me just do that. Simply put, the internet was not designed to be defended. Think about it. The internet was designed, as one Army intelligence officer told me, so that professors could exchange good ideas. Something that was never designed to be defended is almost impossible to defend completely after the fact. So, you know, are the technical experts here in Silicon Valley, can they be of assistance? I'm sure they can. Can they be of help? I'm sure they can. But the likelihood that we can make the grid impermeable to cyber attack is next to nil, at least now. And whatever plans I've heard would take years to implement. So we're in a very dangerous period.
Well, one audience member here actually asks specifically if the Electric Power Research Institute is involved, if they have a program in this area, just up the road here in Palo Alto.
I have no idea. Don't know.
And let's follow up on what you were saying about Iran, because after the Stuxnet virus attack, that wasn't without its own blowback
The Iranians apparently responded by attacking Aramco, which is a Saudi Arabian-American oil company, gigantic. And what they did is they knocked out 30,000 of Aramco's computers so that they simply showed a burning American flag. And the assumption is that the Iranians opted to attack the Saudis, A, because they are a Shiite community and the Saudis are a Sunni, and secondly, because I surmise, they didn't want to take on the Israelis and they didn't want to directly take on the United States, but they wanted to send a message. And the message was clear. You've just done this to us. We can do something similar to you. You're playing a very dangerous game. And a dangerous game it is.
So even if we're not talking about a cyber attack, here's a question about just grid overload. What examples have you seen in the research you've done for the book in terms of the private sector activity to enable grid independence and resiliency during critical power loads?
Look, there are a number of communities around the country. They tend to be smaller communities, not big cities, that have created their own microgrids, which are independent of the three main grids in the United States. It takes a lot of community action, it takes money, it takes time. It's a very good idea. For reasons that you can easily understand, the power industry as a whole is not thrilled by the idea of these independent microgrids. Nevertheless, it's a step in the right direction.
So who should have the plan? Who should be in charge here?
Since we made the era of creating the Department of Homeland Security in the first place, and you know, putting all of these other federal agencies under the DHS, it ought to be the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security, let me put it this way, there is an agency in Washington, an organization that annually runs a survey of the top as in largest, 19 federal agencies in Washington to determine what the morale in each agency is, the level of efficiency in each agency, Let me simply put it this way. The Department of Homeland Security comes in 19th in 18 out of 19 categories, and in the other category, it comes in 18th. And I forget what that other category was. So, you know, the notion that the agency with the lowest morale, lowest efficiency rating, is the one that carries the greatest burden of defending us in a time of national crisis is not one that fills me with a great deal of confidence.
And so who would you want in terms of leading the charge on beefing up cybersecurity?
Well, I mean, ultimately, look, the man who is in charge of FEMA, his name is Craig, it'll come to me, Craig Fugate. Craig Fugate is phenomenal. He is probably the best person in the country to lead this kind of effort, but FEMA is subordinate to the Department of Homeland Security. As he told me, it's difficult for me sometimes because by the time decisions are made, I come in, you know, late into the process. I'd like to see a man like him in charge of the operation. When I asked him very bluntly, you know, what's the best you could hope for in the event of an attack like this, and he believes an attack like this is very likely, he said, the best I could hope to do is keep the number of deaths down to a minimum. That's not encouraging, but it's realistic.
Well, you talk about in the book how there's a whiff of defeatism about preparation for an inevitable attack.
Yeah, well, look, I'll tell you about a conversation I had with. I have spoken to every Secretary of Homeland Security going back to Tom Ridge, who was the first. And I spent an hour with Jay Johnson, who was the current Secretary of Homeland Security. And again, I emphasize, Jay Johnson is a very smart man. He was chief counsel at the Pentagon. But I refer to the late, great Will Rogers, who used to say, we're all ignorant just about different things. Mr. Johnson he has not made this a subject that tops his agenda. And when I asked him what the plan was, he rambled on for about 12 minutes and never answered the question, and I pressed him. And he said, what is this, some kind of test? And I said, no, I think it's a reasonable question to ask. Department of Homeland Security ought to be in charge of this. What's the plan? Is there a plan? And he sort of gestured up behind him to a shelf where there were about a dozen white binders. And he said, I'm sure there's a plan up there somewhere. And I said, well, explain to me the logic of not revealing the plan to the American public now while there is no crisis and while you have every means of communication available to you. What would be the advantage of waiting until after the crisis hits, until the power is out and television doesn't work and radios don't work? He said, battery-powered radio. You've got to have a battery-powered radio. And I said, I'll accept that, but what is it you're going to tell me on my battery-powered radio that you can't tell me now? And clearly, the two of us were not hitting it off. And one of his assistant secretaries stepped in, and the interview was mercifully ended, mercifully for both of us. But it, you know, it didn't fill me with a lot of confidence. And I realized there's a certain smart-ass quality to a reporter coming in and saying, what's the plan? This is not the kind of plan that needs to be an object of national security. It's a plan for survival. We're the ones, you're the ones who have to know what you're going to do. And, you know, I spend three chapters in the book talking about the Mormons because the Mormons have done a terrific job of planning. And it, you know, it really is possible for communities all over America to form associations so that at the very least, every neighborhood has a group with different levels of expertise, so that you have a nurse, or you have a doctor, you have an electrician, you have a plumber. You have people who really can help you in a time of crisis get over it. You know, ideally, we'd want to hear about that from the government beforehand, but we're not. And I would very much like to see the beginning of a national dialogue on that subject, and what better time, after all, than during a presidential campaign.
Is there anyone who's come out and you would say, well, this candidate seems to get it, or is this not on the radar at all?
Actually, there was only one candidate who mentioned it in one of the debates, and that was Jim Webb, and he dropped out. So, no, there is no candidate right now.
So where are the greatest vulnerabilities in the system right now?
Where would you like to begin? Every power grid is dependent on large power transformers. This is going to get a little wonky, so forgive me, but when power is generated, large power transformers step up the wattage so that electricity can be sent along those high power wires that you see along the side of our highways and along the side of our railroad tracks, so that they can be sent, so the electricity can be sent at high speed. And then when it gets to the other end, to the delivery point, we have large power transformers which step down the power so that it then can be sent to your homes and your places of business. Those large power transformers, and there are many, many thousands of them, are uniquely built to meet the standards of each company that is using. We have 3,200 companies. All of these large power transformers are unique to the particular company. So if one goes down, and on average, they're 38 to 40 years old, these large power transformers. They are huge. They weigh between 400 and 600,000 pounds. They cost about $10 to $12 million. And here's the kicker. Where do you think they're made? Not here in the United States. They are made overseas. And it takes from the time that a large power transformer is ordered until the time that it is delivered, approximately 1 to 2 years. So, you know, you had an incident not too far from here.
The Metcalf
substation. Metcalf, that's right, where a substation had, I believe it was 17 of its large power transformers shot out by AK-47s. To this day, the Wall Street Journal did an absolutely brilliant coverage of this story. To this day, that story has never been found to be lacking in accuracy. Everything that the reporter reported turned out to be accurate. The head of the federal agency that theoretically controls or sets the regulations for the power industry, it's called FERC, the then head of the agency brought in some folks from the Navy SEAL operation and had them sort of scour the place where this took place, and they found sort of little piles of stones that appeared to have been set up prior to the attack as aiming points. None of the shell casings had any fingerprints on them. To this day, and it's been well over 2 years now since this happened, the FBI has not been able to come up with even a hint as to who did it. And yet, if this kind of thing were done at a number of power stations, knocking out a number of these large power transformers, theoretically, you could take down the head of FERC at that point estimated that you could actually knock out the power throughout the entire country. I've had the CEO of a power company tell me that was absolute nonsense and it wasn't true. But the fact of the matter is these folks did a pretty good job up the road here. And while the good news was they were able to transfer the power supply to another substation, but that particular substation was out, I think, for 27 days. And the assumption is that somebody was running a dry run kind of operation to see how well they could bring something like this off. They did very well.
So are there other countries, one of the folks in the audience here wants to know, places like France, UK, Germany, that are dealing with this issue? Any lessons that the US might glean?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I didn't look into what other countries are doing. I was really just worried about us, so I can't answer that.
And but you looked at from as we already talked about the Stuxnet virus and then the Iran's response.
Right.
And you know, if we kind of expand the sense of the annals of cyber warfare, you had the what was arguably a Russian attack on Estonia before
right.
that,
and on Georgia, and the North Koreans have attacked South Korea, knocked out the South Korean broadcasting company for a number of days. Banks have been knocked out. It just seems irrational to assume that while every single day there are thousands of cyber attacks on every kind of company, that the only companies that will remain immune to cyber attack are going to be the ones that run our infrastructure. Doesn't make sense.
And how does the security, how do we increase that security? Is this coordination by the NSA? Is this greater regulation? What is it that...
Well, I mean, regulation would make a difference. Part of the problem is that the power industry was deregulated a number of years back. And so whereas in the old days, companies had responsibility for generating power, transmitting power, and delivering power, now it's spread all over the place. As I said to you, 3,200 different companies now operate within the power industry. That's good for you, because it has brought down the price of energy, the price of electricity. It's not good for security, because even though the big companies are secure, the small companies are not. And if you can get into one, you can work your way back to the systems. Just again, in the area of things you never thought you'd need to know about or worry about. The nature of electric power and the way that it is delivered requires that there be an absolute balance between the amount of electricity that is generated and the amount of electricity that is consumed. I analogize it to, let's say, a giant balloon that has 3,200 valves, and half of those valves take air in and half of those valves release air. If you get too much air coming in, the balloon bursts. If you have too much air going out, the balloon collapses. If you have too much electricity coming in, more electricity coming in than is being consumed, or more electricity being consumed than is being generated, you're going to have a similar kind of collapse. And at the heart of all of this are so-called SCADA systems. SCADA systems are supervisory control and data analysis systems. It's the internet at work. If you can get into those SCADA systems, and to repeat, the Chinese are in and the Russians are in, you can do enormous damage.
So you've captured a couple of things that really seem to be in the zeitgeist here. One is, you know, this book seems to cover the territory of post-apocalyptic fiction. Which actually I think you can talk about specifically in terms of a cyber attack. But two, we're not exactly living in a time when people want to trust the government with more information and see government as being the solution to this kind of a problem.
I get it. Get over it. Look, I realize I'm in Northern California, and this may not be the most popular thing to say in Northern California, but the fact of the matter is the most skilled people in this country, the ones who have the best chance of defending us against cyber attack, are the scientists at the NSA, that same company that is scarfing up your private information. And somehow we're going to have to deal with this issue of the balance between security and privacy. You know, you seem perfectly comfortable with the notion that Amazon and Google and so on get all kinds of your private information off your computer system and use that to market product, right? People buy that information from Amazon and Google and then in turn come back to you and try to sell you stuff that they believe you would want. That's okay with you for some reason, all right? All I'm saying to you is, ask yourselves the question whether you would rather have your private information, and I have no doubt, I mean, I'm not suggesting that I think the NSA is being run by a bunch of Boy Scouts. It's not. I have no doubt that our private information is being vacuumed up. I also have no doubt that Chinese intelligence and Russian intelligence and Iranian intelligence and Syrian intelligence, they're all doing the same damn thing. And in the final analysis, I want to give the NSA the tools that they need to protect us, if indeed we can be protected. I have little or no confidence in the ability of the Department of Homeland Security to do it.
So here someone in the audience says, miss you on TV. What are your current projects?
What the hell do you think this book is? That's
They're also asking about your daughter, Andrea.
My daughter, Andrea, actually is the one who said, Dad, is this your autobiography? My daughter, Andrea, is, in fact, even as we speak, just up the road in Redwood City. She is a senior vice president for Mercy Corps, which is, she has gone from the dark side as a journalist to now working for one of the most extraordinary charitable organizations in the country. Mercy Corps really does the Lord's work in many, many countries. And my daughter, who actually left television so she could spend more time at home with her son, she now ends up in North Korea, she ends up in Afghanistan, she ends up in all the nastiest places in the world, but she's doing good work. Thank you for asking.
So I have a question about the quarter century that you spent with Nightline. Do you feel like that you changed the shape of conversation in the news in the United States?
I don't know if we changed it. I think we did something during those 25 years that maybe is a little scarcer on television today. We focused back then on stories that we thought you needed to know about. I realize I could probably entertain you a whole lot more by telling you juicy stories about the Kardashians. That's what television news does to a large degree these days. It focuses on the kind of information that we think, they do surveys on it and they can tell. Information on the Kardashians is infinitely more interesting than information on a possible cyber attack against the grid. You know, this is complicated stuff. It requires hard work on the reporter's part, and it even requires hard work on the reader's part. I promise you it's not a terribly wonky book. There are some fairly entertaining segments in it, but it's not an easy slog for some of the chapters. But isn't that, in the final analysis, what our system of government is about? It is having an educated public that is capable of selecting its representatives on the basis of information rather than on the basis of sound bites, rather than on the basis of, you know, the kind of theater that has been going on our television screens for the last couple of months. I cite my favorite statesman, Winston Churchill, who once said memorably, "The Americans always end up doing the right thing, but only after they've exhausted every other possibility."
So I was going back and reading one of your earlier books before this evening, was struck by the fact that you began in your journal at the beginning of 1999 writing that you had this deep-seated fear that perhaps 1999 might be the last year before the war began.
Yeah. Every once in a while, we get it right. I mean, 2 years later, that's exactly what happened. And you know, I worry Tom Ridge had a really smart observation. He said, you know, Americans are a reactive society. We're not very good at preemptive action. I'm trying to stimulate a discussion that will cause us to be preemptive. If you take a look at everything that came in the wake of 9/11, everything, two wars, thousands of dead, 7,000 or 8,000 dead American troops, hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis and Afghans, $3 trillion of money expended. You ever think about what $1 trillion is? Let me explain $1 trillion to you so you'll never forget it. I want you to imagine a business that began in the year that Jesus Christ was born. And that business proceeds to lose $1 million on its first day in operation. And it then proceeds to lose another $1 million every day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Year after year after year. It would be another 1,000 years from today before that business lost $1 trillion. We have expended $3 trillion. And when you consider the casualties, and when you consider the impact that it's had on this country, I have to conclude that Osama bin Laden launched arguably the most successful attack on the United States ever. He cannot have dreamed that we would do to ourselves what we have done. As you look at the Middle East today, I mean, I am no great fan of Donald Trump, but when Donald Trump says that Iraq was actually a more secure place when Saddam Hussein was alive than it is today, when he says that Libya actually was a more secure place when Gaddafi was alive than it is today, I can't disagree with him. I mean, when Iraq and Iran were at war, as they were for almost 9 years in the 1980s, you know who we supported? Saddam Hussein. Because we were more concerned about the Iranians and how they would damage U.S. interests in the Persian Gulf than we were about Iraq. And so given the choice between the two, we gave intelligence information, we supplied, you know, I mean, the great joke was, and it was a sad, bitter kind of joke, in the run-up to the war in 2003, the joke in Washington was, we know Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. We still have the receipts. We and the French and the Germans and the British provided Saddam Hussein with the wherewithal to make some of that poison gas and some of those chemical weapons that he then used against his own people. So, you know, we don't just react to crisis. We overreact to crisis. The TSA, right? Those nice folks in their blue uniforms who greet you and check to make sure that you're not bringing a water bottle through the checkpoint, right? The TSA now has 55,000 employees. Since it was created in 2001, it has cost the American taxpayer $100 billion. And yet, when Homeland Security, which is the parent organization of TSA, ran a security check last spring, where it sent inspectors to some of these airport checkpoints, you know, they tried to go through those checkpoints with fake bombs and fake weapons and fake ammunition. You know what the success rate of the TSA was in finding those bombs? 5%. 95% failure rate. In other words, they succeeded in getting the bombs through 95% of the time. That's what we've spent $100 billion on. That's why when I say to you, I think it would probably be a better expenditure if our government were to spend $100 billion over the next few years getting warehouses full of freeze-dried food, which lasts 25 to 30 years. Then in the event of a catastrophe, whether that catastrophe is an earthquake in Los Angeles or whether it's a cyber attack, you know, on the East Coast, at least the food will be there. What they storehouse now are the MREs, the meals ready to eat, that our military uses. And they're terrific. The problem is they have a shelf life for 5 years. So the government never buys much more than it thinks it's going to need during that five-year period. Therefore, in the time of a massive crisis that would affect tens of millions of people, the government will not have enough food to feed us. I think that's something we could deal with, but it's going to require preemptive action.
Failure of imagination, writes one audience member. Will this
Failure
of imagination.
Ah, yes.
Will this be the explanation for the lack of preparation, like for the 9/11 attacks? And how can we improve the imagination?
Keith Alexander, whom I referenced a moment ago, the former director of the NSA, said, and pardon my French, he said, you know, we tend to be up to our ass in alligators. And we, you know, the people running our government deal with the alligators they've got. They've got the Afghan alligator, they've got the Pakistani alligator, they've got the ISIS alligator, they've got the Iranian alligator. There are alligators all over the world. And he said, in the military, we have an officer who is tasked with future planning. The civilian government doesn't tend to do that quite as much. They focus on the problems we have right now, not the problems that are looming just over the horizon. I think we need to learn from that. He's right.
You know, when you were talking about the needing to warehouse food, one of the things that came to mind for me was some years I spent living in Ukraine in the 90s when the economic situation was horrendous.
Right.
And people knew you couldn't count on the infrastructure for regular electricity, water, and everyone had their little plot of land out in the countryside where they could actually grow some vegetables.
Yeah.
And you could always survive no matter how bad things got.
I think people in our rural areas are going to do a lot better than people in our urban centers. And, you know, when I talk about the kind of food that, first of all, somebody pointed out to me at an event that I was doing yesterday, he said, you know, you can't just talk to people about freeze-dried food. They're going to think you can just take this freeze-dried food out of the package and start scarfing it down. It needs to be reconstituted with water. You have to heat that water, right, so that you can turn it into a palatable meal. And he said, the other problem is it does constipate, which I suppose is one way of dealing with the health crisis that I was talking about before.
Well, here one person wants to know, so when we run out of the food and water within 7, 28 days, 180 days, then what?
Well, hopefully by then somebody will have come up with a greater solution. I mean, one of the things that needs to be considered, one of the things for which we need to make plans. I've been talking about all or part of one grid going down. When you get your copies, or if you have copies of the book right now, and you look at the cover, you will see that what is blacked out is essentially all of the East Coast past Chicago. That's the Eastern Grid, the Eastern Interconnect. Then you've got a little lighted area, which is Texas. They have their own grid, and then you have your own area here, the West Coast. Where was I going? Oh, it's not all, I mean, the whole country is not going to be in darkness. So the logical thing that we will begin to to deal with is you're going to have many, perhaps even millions, of domestic refugees heading toward the light. That sounds like a solution. Until you consider what the hospitality will be when you get to those states that have the light, I will tell you that I am aware of one rural state, not too terribly far from Washington, D.C., whose governor decided that he and his staff needed to talk about what they would do in the event that there was a crisis in Washington and all those Washingtonians started heading down toward his state. And so they decided on a plan which would activate the National Guard, the Sheriff's Department, the state police, all of whom would be at the major highways. And as each car came in, they would hand them a bottle of water for each person in the car, a sandwich, and a map to the nearest gas station, and tell them to keep going because the state does not have sufficient infrastructure to handle you. All I'm saying is we have to at least begin talking about the fact that those of you who think you're going to jump in your car and drive to Oregon or Washington or Nevada or Utah or wherever it may be had best consider what your welcome is going to be when you get there. Those of you with tons of money may indeed be welcome. Those of you without tons of money may not be welcome. Again, is it a subject that we ought to be discussing? Is it possible that we could actually set up internal, it's a horrible phrase, but refugee centers for our own fellow citizens? I'd rather talk about it beforehand and hear what the various governors and state legislatures of these states have to say about that beforehand than count on the hospitality of people who are suddenly being inundated. Look at Western Europe today, which after all is being inundated by quite literally millions of desperate people. I'm not suggesting that it would be an identical scene here in the United States, and I am sure that there are many wonderful, hospitable people who would do everything they could. But when the numbers get up into the millions, and you're talking about people who may have been able to bring a couple of $1,000 with them, but that's it. That's it. And they're saying, please, sir, can we stay for the next 6 months? What do you think the reaction is going to be? I don't know. But I'd like to talk about it.
Well, Ted Koppel, thank you so much for bringing us Lights Out for the conversation this evening. I actually do have one last quick question, but also want to, I think, express thanks and admiration on behalf of the audience here for not just this book and your time with us here this evening, but for decades, for really illuminating the world in important and thoughtful
ways.
That's
very nice of you. Thank you.
So the last question is, so who's one interview that you haven't done yet or that you didn't get the chance to do that you really would have?
Well, I'd love to sit down with Pope Francis. I actually met Pope Francis last summer. And being the smart ass that I am, I knew I was going to meet him and just have a chance to say a very few words. And so I practiced something in Italian. And I said it to him in Italian. Now, I don't speak Italian. The problem was, apparently, I got it out fairly well because he responded in Italian, and I didn't understand a word of what he was saying. So if I get a chance to interview the Pope, we'll do it through an interpreter or in English if he's willing to. I'll tell you what, this has been such a downer of an evening. I'm going to leave you on a lighter note. I've been doing this for a very long time. Back in 1972, I was with Richard Nixon when he went to China. And Nixon, as all first time visitors to China do was taken out to the Great Wall. And my colleague Tom Jarrell was what we call the pool correspondent. When you can't have a whole bunch of reporters there, a pool correspondent represents everybody else and then brings the information back. And Tom took his microphone, stuck it in President Nixon's face, and said, "Mr. President, what do you think of the wall?" And President Nixon, who was a very smart man, but not much given to small talk, responded by saying, "Well, one can only say, upon looking..." This is actually a pretty damn good Nixon, you know. For, for those of you too young to remember, that's, you know. "One can only say, upon looking at this wall, that this is truly a great wall." Swear to God, that's what he said. So on the... No, there's more. So on the flight to Shanghai from Beijing, the thought came to me that he's president of the United States. I mean, he's got all these smart people working for him. Somebody could have anticipated the question and come up with something better. So in my fevered imagination, I saw the president singing a song that I wrote for just such an eventuality. And it goes something like this. In fact, it goes exactly like this. "It's a grand old wall. It's a long-standing wall. Wins the prize for its size and its age. It gave just rewards to the Mongol hordes. Drove the kulaks away in a rage. From Beijing to the seas, it has saved the Chinese till the days of the Kuomintang, from Ming to Han, and on and on. With a great wall, you can't go wrong."
Thank you, Ted Koppel.
See? Ladies and cyber attacks, come on.
Ladies and gentlemen, this program was brought to you this evening by the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. Now, while you might not have enjoyed the message, I know you enjoyed the messenger, Ted Koppel. We are so grateful for you being here, author of Lights Out, A Cyber Attack, A Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath, and of course, Stephen Sohm, the editor of Santa Clara Magazine. We want to thank also our audience here in Santa Clara and those of you who are joining us on the radio. And now, regrettably, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.